again, everybody. It is time for the Mainland Podcast, episode 134. And I don't know how to even open this particular show because I'm not used to opening it after a six-point weekend. But that is exactly what we had. Let me bring in my co-host, David Rowe. 6 points this weekend between the Lions and the Pride.
I didn't think we could count that high anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just what happened.
I don't know. Somebody must have messed up. That's all I could say.
There was obviously something wrong.
There was also obviously a mix-up. Something got lost in the mail. I don't know. Something happened. But good things happened. By the way, I didn't introduce myself. I'm Michael Citro, the managing editor of themainland.com. Over at SB Nation, we cover Orlando City and the Orlando Pride. That's why we're very excited to have a victory for both teams this past weekend. Orlando City getting a home victory against Toronto FC, something that has been quite elusive. That was only the second time Orlando City has beaten Toronto FC since joining MLS in 2015. And the Pride getting their first ever victory against the Utah Royals after drawing twice earlier this season. Falling behind early in that game, and it didn't really look like that team was going to be able to come back and post a road victory on short rest, but they did exactly that. So a lot to talk about, and we'll just dive right into James O'Connor's first home game as Orlando City head coach. Dave, I did not know what to expect going into this game. I know one thing that I did not expect was to see Earl Edwards Jr. Penciled in to the starting 11 at goalkeeper, where Joe Bendick has been a fixture for the last couple of years.
One would think that would be the case, but when it happened, I wasn't completely surprised. You and I have spoken off air about Joe is not having the year that he's had in the past, and when a new skipper comes to town and is going to give everybody a fair shake, if you've got a guy that's been giving up goals, why not give the young gun a chance? So while I agree with you that Bendick's been a fixture. I mean, he was up there in total minutes of every, player having played. It's still I did get some reactions from some other people going, whoa. But every time that I heard something like that, I was kind of like, let's see what happens. It wasn't as surprising to me as it would have been, say, a month ago.
Yeah, for me, the big surprise is the fact that since Joe has been here, he has played every minute he's been healthy in terms of league games. And, it didn't seem like – it has always seemed like the coaches, whoever the coach has been, has always considered the gap between the starter and the backup on this team to be significant enough to never give the backup minutes unless it's in an early round U.S. Open Cup game. Or a friendly. It has never been like, you get a turn, you get a turn. You sure typically want to have a number one guy for sure. But Joe had played, I guess, well enough earlier in his Orlando City tenure that, he wasn't losing his spot. This year, you and I don't know how many times I've said on this program this year, I think Joe could have done a little bit better on that goal. But it seems like I've said it a lot this year. I think that there have been quite a few moments this year where Joe has allowed a goal from a bad angle to go through his legs, or like against LA last week, giving up a rebound that probably should have just been a straight catch. It just seemed like he's been a bit off his game this year. And so from that perspective, I'm not surprised that, James O'Connor went and gave Earl Edwards Jr., a game. But from the other perspective of this guy's just always in the lineup, you can count on it, that was a bit surprising. So Earl Edwards Jr., the landlord, gets his MLS second ever MLS game and his first game of the season in MLS. And he rose to the challenge. He wasn't tested a lot, but when he was tested, including a very crucial 1v1 with a guy named Sebastian Giovinco that a lot of people have heard of. He came up huge, and he did a great job with his – I will say that his distribution was mixed. His throw distribution was fantastic. His kicking distribution could use, you know, some work, and we, you know, that's something that we talked about even when he was with OCB, is that sometimes his goal kicks, his placement on long passes has not been real good, not been real sharp, but his throws, boy, you know, do the old you know, the chef kiss there.
he's got an all-star center fielder's arm on him for sure. Just accurate, getting right where it needs to be, and like you said, that his distribution from the arm helped create chances during the game.
Mm-hmm. Now, Orlando City and Toronto came out and played a lot of the first half between the two penalty areas. It was really difficult for either team to really get a whole lot going. But Orlando City did start to gain some momentum, look like the more dangerous side. And lo and behold, not really sure how this happened, who in the league screwed up, but Orlando City got to get on the scoreboard first for the first time since, I don't know, ever.
somebody when they plugged in the game, they put the positive on the negative and the negative on the positive. It threw everything off.
Okay, yeah, it was totally screwed up. But one of the guys who was dangerous throughout the game is a guy by the name of Dom Dwyer. And he sent an absolute smashed shot at Alex Bono, and he could not handle the shot. Could not handle it, could do nothing but fight it off. And one guy who would you maybe not suspect of reacting before any other player was the first to react, and that was Chris Schuler. Chris Schuler gets to the ball first. He read it. He says, no way Bono's stopping that shot. I'm going to get there for the rebound. He sure did, and headed home his first goal as an Orlando City player.
And good for Chris Schuler. You know, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt that he reacted before everybody else, which, if you go back, he did. The joke could just be that he's such a tall guy that it just looked like he reacted first, but just when he takes a step, it's just that much longer than anybody else. But no, you're right. I mean, he read it fantastically. It was a guy who's been, you know, a veteran guy. You know, maybe hasn't had the most illustrious career, but you know, he's been playing a long time, and he knows the game. And it, like you say, just steps up, puts the head on the ball perfectly. We go up 1-0, and I think we were all having the same reaction of, you know, we're all doing the Ricky Bobby, I don't know what to do with my hands.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I had to look at the replay three times to make sure Schuler was onside. I had to look at it and go, was he really? Because he was so far behind the defense when he got to that ball. It was like nobody knew that ball was coming back out except
for Chris Schuler. Yeah.
And sure enough, I mean, it was not even close. I was like, wow, he really did. He really, and he said after the game that he said, I didn't think there was any way he was stopping that shot. So I just crashed the net. So,
well, we get back to my joke about how far he can move with one step, but that kind of does contribute to how he was able to get up there.
Well, it's a good thing he can cover ground with one step, because he's not the fastest guy. So good for Chris.
That's true.
Congratulations on the first goal as a Lion, and it was nice to take a 1-0 lead, and the crowd was very much into it at that point. And then from that point on, it really looked like Orlando City was always going to score a second goal at some point. It didn't come before halftime, but it didn't take long in the second half for that to happen, as you know, Mueller found Dwyer in some space, and Dwyer just got to the top of the box and just ripped an unstoppable shot to make it 2-0, and then we got the backflip.
Well, Dwyer figured that he had ripped that first one, and it worked out so well. Why not try it again, and this time maybe even hit it a little bit harder? So it was, yeah, we did get the backflip, which was fantastic. I think he was really feeling it that night. And you know, more so, I think the entire team, I mean, if you look at how much on the attack they were, and not just in the attacking half, but all over the field, they were moving to the ball better than I've seen in months. You know, there was an energy that we haven't seen recently, and it definitely showed.
There was quite a bit of rotation amongst the midfielders, both the defensive mids and the attacking mids. I went back after the game and looked at the heat maps of some of the players, and one of the things I noticed during the game was that a guy who killed Orlando when the team went to Toronto and they lost that heartbreaker late is Ryan Telfer, who was just absolutely destroying Orlando that night. And he wasn't a factor really at all in this game, Dave. And when I went back and looked at the heat maps, I could see why. If you take a look at the heat maps of Will Johnson, Tony Rocha, Chris Mueller, and RJ Allen, they basically locked down that whole right channel. Will played a little bit more inside. He was helping out with Giovinco. It looked like they were saying, you're not going to beat us with this guy. You're going to have to go to the other side. Oh, by the way, Yoshi Otoon's over there. He didn't play the last time we played you guys. And so right. they made Toronto switch it a lot to Toronto's right. And that just played right into Yotun's ability to win the ball in the middle of the field, and also Elmenir and Kleshchen playing in that area as well. So it was a good, solid tactical game plan by James O'Connor. It was executed well. I think Tony Rocha's inclusion raised a lot of eyebrows, but I think he did a good job in what they asked him to do. Could have scored a goal in this game, had a free header that he put over the net when he really should have done better on, but not known for his scoring prowess. So we'll take what he gave on Saturday in helping to shut down Toronto's attack. When it was 2-0, Orlando City did seem to lose a little bit of foot off the gas, and either that or Toronto just woke up, because they really started to get the ball to Giovinco, and Giovinco just by himself tried to lift his team, tried to put the team on his back. He made some incredible moves to get into good shooting locations. He couldn't find the net. The one time he did get slipped in, just a fantastic ball by Michael Bradley, slipped him in behind, and you thought, oh crap, here it is, here's the goal. And Earl Edwards Jr. came up huge with his biggest save of the night, and preserved that, and eventually Toronto's attack seemed to peter out a little bit, but they really were, for a good 15-20 minute segment of the second half, they were really on the front foot. They weren't getting a lot of good looks, but whenever Giovinco's on the ball, you just hold your breath.
Exactly right. And I was literally holding my breath some of the times whenever he would get the ball, because it's Giovinco. He is a prolific scorer in MLS. And you're right. You're sitting there thinking, especially on that one where Bradley put him through, you're like, okay, here we go. The landlord makes the save. He had a couple other ones that obviously weren't on target. And for a little bit, at least that first part of that Toronto attack, it almost felt like, this is how the season's going to go. They're going to go ahead. They're going to get this goal. It's going to be 1-1 or 2-1, and then there's going to be lots of time. But it didn't come to be. And that once again, I wasn't sure how to react to that as I was watching it. I was just, this hasn't been happening. What's going on? I'm not sure. Two other points. Let's get it up to Tony Rocha. The minutes that he's had when he's been on the field have been good quality minutes. We kind of joked about that one time where, he was, I think he might've been our man of the match. He's played well, he's making the most of his opportunity. And then the second thing is, how good is it to have Yotun back? I mean, how much better do you feel with him on the field? I know it warms my heart.
Yeah, he didn't play particularly well at LA, but that was his first game back from, coming back from Russia in the World Cup. And sometimes it takes some adjustment to get back to your old team. And, of course, he's with a new coach and everything. So he was his old self on Saturday against Toronto. It was good to see. He had a monster game and was a big part of the victory. Earl was about 25 seconds from getting his first MLS shutout. But Amro Terek with a bad decision, maybe a 94th minute tiredness fouls. Jay Chapman just outside the area. Giovinco's over the ball, but it's on the right side. You're thinking, okay, he can't go for goal here, so maybe we're in good shape, just need to clear it. But he puts it to the back post, and Mohamed Elmounir fell asleep and did not notice the danger from Nick Haglund running in from out of nowhere. I mean, if this was a WWE wrestling, he would have been coming in from behind, backstage, and he came running in.
Leaping
out of
in
nowhere.
With the chair, yeah.
Yeah, he came in and cut in front of Elmounir and caught him sleeping. And, that happens after 94 minutes of running hard. You can sometimes switch off for a second, lose your concentration. You can't do that against a team like Toronto, even with their poor start this year. And Haglund ruins the shutout in just about the last kick of the game. So, but we'll take it. It's a 2-1 victory. It feels weird to say victory, but it snaps a 9-game losing streak. So glad that didn't reach double figures.
Yeah, not only that, but this is the first week in a while that I can say that I was really happy that we were both wrong on our predictions. Mm-hmm. We had the score line correct. We both said 2-1, but we had the wrong team winning. So it never feels this good to be wrong, but it really feels good this week.
Absolutely. Well, I already kind of tipped my hand on man of the match. I thought Dom Dwyer was his old self. I mean, he had 5 shots, 4 of them were on target, created 2 chances for others, got in the heads of those Toronto defenders all night, was very dangerous, and I thought he was my man of the match. He could have probably... had he held up a couple runs, probably could have gotten Chris Mueller to score some more goals, because Chris was deferring to him a little too much in the area. But for me, Dom was the top player of the game.
Yeah, as much as I liked seeing Yotun back in form, and as much as I love watching Chris Mueller do what he does, there was no doubt that it was Dom this week. The goal, the assist, and just his demeanor. I mean, he was... there was a fire in his play that is good to see. You could see it in his eyes, and I thought that, like I say, I mean, he does what he did what he does when he's playing well, which is create havoc for the other team, and then the 2 shots that result in goals were just ridiculously, I mean, they were freaking fireballs from distance. So it's no doubt, man of the match.
All right. Well, it's pretty awesome to be talking about an Orlando City win again. It's been a while on this podcast since we've done that for an MLS game. We've done it a little more recently for U.S. Open Cup. We'll talk a little bit more about the U.S. Open Cup later in this very program. One game that started an hour before Orlando City was the Orlando Pride. As I really hate when they do that, but they scheduled them very close together. And the Pride were out in Utah, had not beaten Utah, the only team in the league that the Pride had never tasted victory against. And they go out there and promptly fall behind early 1-0 on an Amy Rodriguez goal. I really don't know what... the back line is doing half the time for this Pride team sometimes, because they have opponents outnumbered and lose the battle way too often. Monica is an international. She plays in the biggest tournaments on the world's biggest stages against the world's best players. And she should be more physical, more aggressive, and should be able to shut down players 1v1 half the time at least, let alone when she's got help from Shalina Zdorsky. And the two of them together should definitely be able to shut down one player, even a good player like Amy Rodriguez. And it's just not good enough to be near an offensive player. You have to be on them. You have to be in their pocket. You have to be jostling them. You have to be creating doubt in their mind and making them uncomfortable. And that is not something that this Pride team has been doing defensively. And it led to the first goal, a goal that, again, I think maybe Ashlyn Harris could do a little bit better, maybe didn't time her jump real well. I think that Ashlyn is having a very similar season in some respects to Joe Bendick.
That's exactly what I was thinking, and it's weird. Obviously Joe has been a stalwart in goal prior to the season, and, of course, Ashlyn's always been considered one of the better goalkeepers in the women's game, but you're right. This year, it's they've both oddly been just a little bit off, and that's hurt both teams so far. Fortunately, in this game, it wasn't enough to keep the Pride from getting all 3 points. But still, you're right. It's not the first time that we've said Ashlyn could have played that ball better, just like with Joe. Mm-hmm.
No Marta in this game. She was suspended for the red card she picked up at Houston in the midweek. But going on the road at altitude and playing on short rest, it didn't look good for the Pride to go behind by a goal early. And Pride did have chances. Alex Morgan had a chance early in the game that she had a good opportunity in the box to score, but Abby Smith got her leg on it. I think it hit her knee, the bend of her knee, about like 4 inches away, and that's a goal. 4 inches different placement by Alex. So they had some chances, but it wasn't until late in the first half that the Pride were able to level it. Corner kick, Alana Kennedy gets hogtied in the box, and the referee spots it. Joy of joys, after the Houston dash were only whistled for two fouls the entire game, the previous game.
Yeah.
The referee gets that one right, and Alex lines up, and I don't know what the referee was doing. I mean, we've had our issues with the referees. I would say this about NWSL referees. They make MLS referees look great by comparison. While she's getting this whole thing organized, she's allowing Abby Smith to stand basically right in Alex's face and just to sit there and get in her head for a good couple of minutes. And I was thinking, there's no way Alex makes this shot, because she's going to have to hold her composure through, pretty – Abby Smith's big. She's kind of can be intimidating, I guess, and she's right in her grill, and she's just allowed to do it. And Alex is looking at the ref like, come on. You got to tell her to get back. And so anyway, they line up, and Alex, great placement, good composure, puts it in the top of the net, and makes it 1-1, and the Pride are in the game. So it's 1-1, and you're thinking, well, anything can happen. And even on the road against a good team like Utah, a draw is probably not the worst thing you can have. But then in the second half, just a great heads-up play by Kristen Edmonds, a player who's been a little bit snake-bitten this year, and has not been producing a lot, and really hasn't been getting a lot of opportunities, but she was wise enough to know Abby Smith likes to roam. She was sharp enough to spot that Smith was off her line, and a great chip shot, and that put her in the running for goal of the week, because it ended up being the game winner as Kristen Edmonds made it 2-1.
Yes, it was, and it was a fantastic chip shot. As you said, it's in the running for goal of the week, so if you haven't already, go out and vote for Kristen for that one. It's, back on the Morgan penalty kick, it's funny, when she hasn't had somebody up in her grill, she's hit the post and other things. So, maybe it helped. Maybe it gave her a little bit of a chip on her shoulder, and she was able to bury it. Who cares why? But it was good that she did. And then, like I say, the other one is a goal of the week contender and hopefully a winner, because it would be good to have that. And good for Kristen, like I said, having not the best season to get that. Maybe that helps her out as well.
Yeah. So that was all for the scoring. Utah was, not terribly threatening. I don't think Harris had a lot to do in the game. It was surprising, because they had Kristen Press now, and she has done well against the Pride in the past. And on the other end, they had a defender pull one off the line, so it really could have been a 3-1 game. So, but Tom Sormani's team bounces back with a win, 2-1 at Utah. Big, big victory for the Pride as they continue to try to solidify a playoff position with the games winding down. I think there's six or seven left now. And it was very important to get points of some kind after losing a very disappointing loss in the midweek to Houston. We didn't really get into that game. Not a lot worth getting into in that game. It was a very poorly played game by Orlando, I thought. That was the game really where you noticed a lot of defensive struggles in terms of positioning, in terms of players getting in behind, and just goals that should never have happened. The Pride should have done better in that game against Houston than they did. And a team that's, barely struggling to stay on the fringes of the playoff race. And you should have had a chip on your shoulder going in, because you just lost to them the previous week. You got to do better than that. And Orlando didn't do very well in that game, and I'm not blaming any of it on the officiating, but I will say had some opportunities for some good free kicks early in the game right around the top of the box. Nothing was called. Nothing was getting called in that game, Dave. Houston didn't get called for a foul in that game until more than an hour of the game had passed. And
right.
As I said, only two. When's the last time that any soccer team only got two fouls called in an entire soccer game? Orlando had 10, which is, I think, still a little on the low side, but it's like a little bit more realistic than two.
Well, yeah, and I'm going to argue a little bit about nothing was getting called. Nothing was getting called on them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, Marta was sent off, so, I mean, that's a big one.
Well, a little bit of loss of composure for the Pride late in that game. Four yellows and a red fly for the Pride.
After nothing getting called, you're going to be frustrated as all get out. Not saying that it's good to do, but it's certainly understandable.
Not all of those were warranted. I thought Carson Pickett's was kind of a soft yellow, and there was a yellow early in that game to Rachel Hill. Or I'm sorry, I'm getting my games confused. A little bit early in the game against Utah to Rachel Hill, when she got flattened, got a foul called on her. She didn't know why. Then 2 seconds later, she's clipped somebody's heel from behind and she gets a yellow card. So it was a tough weekend officiating wise. We'll get into that. I saw it was in one of our listener questions. We'll get into the Pride fouls over the last few games here in a bit. It's not been like this all season, but the last few games certainly have been a little bit lopsided. That's not why the team lost to Houston. The team just didn't play well against Houston.
Correct.
And fully credit the Dash for getting all the points. It was a 1-1 game through a lot of it, but yeah, the Pride were not able to pull that out. That's why, again, the win at Utah was huge, huge win. Because you kind of thought going on that trip it might go the other way, winning at Houston and losing at Utah. This way, the net point gain is the same. So,
right.
So they made up for the loss with a win that maybe wasn't totally expected. I kind of thought they'd tie Utah because they did two previous times, but
still, I'll take 3 points. Even if we won it four, I'll still take three.
So the Pride, Dave, a huge game in the playoff race this Saturday afternoon at Orlando City Stadium. It's the, I think it's the game of the week on Lifetime. And, mm-hmm. Thanks to Jill Ellis, there will be no Ashlyn Harris. There will be no Alex Morgan, because those two have been called into the U.S. national team camp ahead of the Tournament of Nations. Also called into the Tournament of Nations for Australia, Emily Van Egmond and Alana Kennedy. But don't fret, they won't miss the game because Australia has a realistic coach and respects the league.
Yes.
And knows that those two extra days aren't going to be the difference between winning and losing the tournament. Yeah, it's frustrating. The spokesperson for U.S. Soccer Federation said, well, everybody knew about the players weren't going to be available for this game and the game earlier in the season as well. But that doesn't excuse the fact that it was unnecessary. It doesn't excuse, Dave, the fact that Jill Ellis didn't have to call these players in as early as she did. In fact, the other ones
Correct.
Were just – The other ones, I mean, these are friendlies, although it's a tournament format, they're still friendlies. The other one was just a pair of friendlies as well. And there was no reason to call them in a couple of days early when they had club games to play, especially since both of these games, Dave, were against Seattle. And it just so happens that Seattle and Orlando are battling for the second and third spot in the NWSL.
Yeah, Jill Ellis has no chill, let's face it. And it was actually in my article earlier or last week, I called it out that it's unfortunate that that's how she goes about it. There are reasons, whatever they are, but if we're trying to grow the women's game, and hopefully we are, and hopefully Jill Ellis is, because I think that having some of the players in the NWSL helps her in her job. One might think that she would give more consideration to something like, the playoff hunt, but evidently not even on our radar.
Right. Now let's say I lived in like Miami and I had, you know, a 12-year-old girl, she wanted to see Alex Morgan play. And I went and said, okay, well, I'm not doing anything, July 21st. Why don't we drive up to Orlando for an afternoon game and we can see Alex Morgan and then have dinner there, maybe stay the night, and then come back on Sunday. And that's all gone because Alex Morgan is no longer eligible for that game. Now, I get it that she could get hurt and you might not have her in that game, but there's nothing you can do about injuries. There's something you can do about calling in a player early when the other nations in the Tournament of Nations are not doing that. I haven't gotten Brazil's schedule yet, but based on what Australia has done and what Brazil has done in the past, I would assume that the Pride's Brazilians will be available this weekend.
One would think so, and one would hope so. Yeah. I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's and you know, you say, well, you know, Seattle's got Megan Rapinoe, you know, that kind of affects both teams equally. Yeah, but I mean, the point is, you've got an important game, and both teams are going to be missing key players, and missing them unnecessarily. That's really the crux of my issue with this, is that it doesn't have to happen. It's two practices they're going to miss. And the Tournament of Nations doesn't mean squat. I mean, this team, you know, with the U.S. Women's National Team, you pretty much know what you've got. There's not going to be any surprises. When qualifying comes against the CONCACAF teams, most likely the U.S. is going to steamroll through most of the CONCACAF competition. It's not the same. You want them to be battle-tested. You want them to be ready. But those two training sessions are not going to change Alex Morgan, because you know what Alex Morgan can do. You know what she's not going to miss a beat because she missed two training sessions, you know, several days ahead of the first game. And Ashlyn Harris is probably not going to play.
And the same with Megan Rapinoe. I mean, you know, she's a longtime vet. Those practices are not going to make any difference. So it's not that we're complaining about just Pride players being called up. It's the ridiculousness of all the players that are in the NWSL that are getting called up for this friendly when it could be affecting NWSL matches, important ones like the Pride versus Reign. So it's happening
across the league.
Correct.
It's not just sour grapes from a Pride fan. It is the fact of the matter is that every week the NWSL stays in business is a win for women's soccer. And it's a win for fans of women's soccer. The U.S. Soccer Federation has a vested interest in this league's success because it provides a platform for their players to stay fit and to compete and to face top-level competition all the time. You're biting the hand that feeds you when you do things that are detrimental to the league. And the league needs its star power because it's already struggling for attendance. So if you take the star power away and it may only cost you, maybe it only costs you a couple hundred, tickets. That's a lot considering the fact that you're only selling 3,000, 3,500 tickets to an Orlando Pride game.
Yeah, if you're talking about a tenth of the revenue, that's a lot.
It's a big chunk, and it's something that you have to be cognizant of. You have to grow the game in this country. Women's soccer is really at a delicate place because it's popular. It's just popular enough that people will start up leagues and pay players to play, but it's not on solid footing by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, we saw that already with Kansas City leaving and also Boston Breakers. I mean, it's recent. It should be in everybody's mind. For this to be happening the very next year when it doesn't have to happen is just ludicrous in my opinion. So I don't want to rail about it too much. I think we've made our points clear on this. We don't like it. We think that Jill should not be doing this. And, big props to Australia for not taking their star players away from NWSL league games this week.
Absolutely.
All right, Dave. Well, in addition to Orlando City having a big U.S. Open Cup matchup against Philadelphia Union tonight, as this podcast drops on the Wednesday the 18th, another game just a few days away in Columbus. We're going to bring in a special guest now to help us talk about this Columbus game and maybe give us some updates on Save the Crew and all that. We're going to talk to our guest right now. After this. All All right, joining us on the Mainland Podcast, we are happy to have back on the program from Massive Report, the Columbus Crew blog over at SB Nation, Patrick Murphy. Pat, how you doing?
I am good. How are you guys?
Terrific.
Good.
We finally got to remember what it felt like to win a game. This past
yeah, I saw that.
So that was nice. I'm sure we won't make it a habit or anything, but it was good. It was good to know the team is actually not going to lose every game until the end of time, because it started to look that way for a bit. But there's a big key matchup in the Major League Soccer Eastern Conference coming up this weekend between Orlando City and the Columbus Crew. If memory serves, Orlando City has never won in Crew Stadium. I would hazard a guess to say that could continue based on the fixtures, the very congested fixture schedule that Orlando City has. But looking at the recent form guide, Patrick, the Crew, only one win in their last eight? How is that even possible with this team?
Well, they can't score goals right now. It's a problem we thought might be an issue coming into the season. Obviously, you guys know where Justin Merrim ended up, and Ola Kamara went out
to
LA.
Justin's not scoring goals either.
Right. But Ola is out in LA, at least to some degree. But yeah, I mean, it was thought to be a issue in the preseason, or heading into the preseason, I guess I should say. They brought in Giassi Zardes, and things seemed to be clicking preseason. That carried over into the start of the year. You know, 5 goals in the first 2 games, 8 goals through the first 4 games. Things seemed to be moving along smoothly. Say what you will about Greg Berhalter's system over the last 4+ years and whatnot, but it's never been an offensive problem. This team has always found ways to score goals. You know, Kai Kamara obviously had a career season. Ola Kamara had 2 good years here. So to see this team kind of lose that scoring touch, you know, you mentioned that stretch. You take out a game against Toronto where they're down 3-0 at home and have to fight back to tie 3-3. You know, they've only got, I'm looking real quick here, 1, 2, 3 goals scored in those 7 other games. So now a decent chunk of those have been on the road where they've only scored 3 goals all year. So that may, not play as big of a part as it will Saturday when they're obviously back at home. But, this team's searching right now. And Giassi Zardes has been a good replacement for Ola Kamara. He's got 10 goals on the year, but he doesn't have much help. Federico Higuain was scoring early in the season. He went through a bit of an injury and is back now, but the wingers aren't producing like they were in previous years. Justin Merrim had a career year last year, Ethan Finley the year before. They thought Pedro Santos was going to be that guy who they brought in the second half of last year, and he's got 1 goal all season. Looks a little bit better these last couple games, but it just, the ball's not finding the back of the net. The chances have been there, but they haven't been as high quality. And even when they are, they're just not scoring. So that's been the big issue over these last 8 games. And I think they're kind of scratching their heads to figure out what to do. They brought in Patrick Mullins late last week. He could be a guy who at least provides some depth and pushes Giassi a little bit more. But it's been interesting because this isn't a team that usually has trouble offensively, and that's definitely been an issue recently.
Now, Patrick, you mentioned Justin Merriman. It had a career year last year for you guys. Yeah. I know you might not want to tell us this prior to the weekend, but where is the on switch for Justin Merriman, and how do we activate him?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think had several other Columbus Crew coaches been able to figure that out before Greg Berhalter got here, they probably would still have jobs with this team because, you look back at his statistics and before, he's got 38 career goals, obviously one with Orlando. And before Greg came in 2014, he had 5 goals. So I think the answer might be Greg Berhalter. it's interesting. And I've talked to some of the other writers around here, after the trade and both the trade for Justin and the trade for Ola to LA about, this would really show how, much a Greg Berhalter system affects these offensive players. And Ola's having a fine season, but he's not scoring at the rate he was before. Obviously, Justin has struggled quite a bit. So I think that's part of it. I also think Justin is a confidence player. When he feels good or when he's motivated, you tend to see him play better. Now, I haven't watched all of the Orlando games this year, but I felt like once he kind of got in a rut, obviously he had the one goal, and I know his celebration was kind of towards the crowd, but once he kind of got in a rut and couldn't dig himself out of it, it became even – he kind of compiled on himself, I guess I would say, watching from afar. And having watched Justin for the first 7, 8 years, whatever it was, of his career, you know, it doesn't entirely surprise me. You know, for a guy that I covered – for quite a long time and got to know a little bit, and for your guys' sake, I hope that he's able to find that form, ideally not Saturday, but he's a guy who works hard his whole career, finally started to really find it, obviously got involved in the Iraqi national team and was quite a contributor for them. And you know, it's been really weird this year because you know, I think it's all there for him. I don't know what it is about this season, Orlando, you know, the coaches, I don't know what, you know, there's nothing I can put my finger on, I guess, that's changed that much that Justin should have just a goal and three assists this year.
Yeah, it's been pretty bizarre considering the fact that even when the rest of the team was going well and winning games earlier in the year, he still wasn't really playing well. And it's kind of funny because he really, his debut game was really a good game. He really played right. Well, and everybody got really excited about him. How is his slump or lack of production being viewed among Crew fans? I mean, is it a big surprise, or is it nah? That just goes to show you how great Greg Berhalter is.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think if you'd ask most Crew fans, they probably would say that even if he'd stayed in Columbus, Justin wasn't going to repeat 13 goals and 7 assists from last year. Also, I think it's worth noting that almost all of that production, especially the goals, came in the first half of the season. I think he had, you know, I want to say like 10 goals before the All-Star break. And, you know, so he slumped the second half of last year in terms of goal scoring. Now he was doing other things. He was getting assists. He was still a contributor. But, you know, I mean, they brought in Kakutamane. At points, they played Kakutamane over Justin Merrim last year. So, you know, it wasn't as if Justin, you know, rode that whole season on a hot streak. His production was largely in the first half of the year. And I also think fans fans in Columbus at least, have really come to appreciate what Greg Berhalter is able to do with attacking players. And I think Josh Wolf, who's an assistant here, deserves a lot of that credit too. Like I mentioned, Justin hadn't done a ton in MLS before Greg and Josh got here. And, you know, this system is geared towards attacking players, and Justin fit in really well playing on the left-hand side and being able to cut in. You know, I don't know why then that doesn't translate to Orlando, because I think at least under Jason Christ, there was a similar philosophy of, you know, we want to play attacking, you know, creative soccer, and Justin seems to fit in with that. But I do think Crew fans have been a little bit surprised that he hasn't produced more. You know, I don't think, as I said, I don't think they thought it was going to be another career year, but one goal and three assists is kind of mind-blowing.
Now, given that Orlando is not scaring anybody right now, what aspects of the Orlando attack give you pause? Like I said, I don't think anybody's scaring anybody right now, but what challenges do you see for Columbus in defending against Orlando this weekend?
Well, first, I think the fact that they're not scaring anybody could be scary. You know, I think there's a lot of talent on this team, and I think that it just hasn't materialized for whatever reason this year. And, you know, I think, and we talked about this locally when Toronto came to town, was you don't want to be that team that the opponent all of a sudden turns things around against. And against Toronto, they found themselves down 3-0 before fighting back. And, you know, I think a lot of that had to do with kind of walking into that game thinking you already had it won. You know, they'd already beaten Toronto at Toronto earlier in the year. And, you know, so I wonder how that will be handled differently this week so that a similar thing doesn't happen. But in terms of, you know, Orlando specifically, I think, you know, Dom Dwyer is always scary. That's a guy who this league, anyone who's followed this league for a while knows. I think that anytime you have a guy like that that can get into the box and, you know, create or be on the end of crosses, get on the end of balls, things like that, you've got to be worried about that. He may even be underrated in this league, you know, given what he's produced throughout his career, you know, multiple 10-plus goal seasons. He's on the pace for another one this year. I think that's one of the guys that Columbus really has to be on the watch for this weekend. You know, the defense has been improved this year. In recent games, they've given up some goals, but it's better. It's not great, but it's better. And, you know, I think that'll be a target for Columbus this week is to keep him off the score sheet. He's also had some success against the Crew in the past, specifically when he was at Kansas City. So, yeah, I think they'll be on the lookout for him and what he can do.
Now, Patrick, we'll just turn this around a little bit and talk about the Orlando City defense. Part of that defense is a guy that played all of 2 minutes for the Crew, Amro Tarek, yeah. who actually kind of looked like a depth signing, but he at times has played like he was seizing a starting role. Now, he's been a little bit uneven since getting back from the Egyptian national team, but you know, what do you think of you know, Tarek coming in and really playing much more you know, I guess a lot more minutes and much better than really anybody even Orlando City probably expected at this point?
I am surprised, and that's not to take anything away from Tarek. I, you know, when he was here, the situation was just very weird. Looked like a player that could contribute on this back line and just obviously, like you mentioned, never did, ended up leaving, you know, before much of the season was over. So nice to see him back in MLS. I appreciated, you know, getting to know him a little bit. One of the guys that does photos for us is also Egyptian, and, you know, got to know him even a little bit better off the field. And, you know, I've always heard good things. So I'm happy to see that he's doing well. But I was surprised that he's, you know, played as much as he has and been a factor for Orlando City. You know, he, for whatever reason, didn't seem to fit with the Crew and MLS. And like I said before, I thought Orlando is a team that likes to play similarly to the Crew. So it was a little bit surprising, but in a pleasant way. And, you know, I wish nothing but the best for him. And, you know, hopefully that I believe he's on loan, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so maybe this is a place that he can land on a permanent basis.
Well, he's, like Michael said, he's actually been one of the more pleasant surprises this season. Right. So, you know, we're kind of hoping so, too. Looking at, you know, the coaching change that we had here recently, obviously you've only got, you know, two MLS games of which, you know, to judge James O'Connor. Obviously he's got his USL time, but, you know, not a lot of tape on the man, so to speak, coming into this match. How do you think the team's going to, you know, game plan for that? What are you expecting? What kind of challenges does that present?
I think it will certainly present challenges just because they don't, as you said, have a lot of game tape. But O'Connor's a guy that Greg Berhalter is decently familiar with, apparently. I didn't know this, but when the whole coaching change happened and they appointed him, Greg spoke, you know, pretty fondly of him. It's a guy, apparently, that he talks to a decent amount. He knew while he was at Louisville. So familiarity, I guess, is there is in some aspect. But once you move teams, you're using different players and things like that. I think that does make it challenging. You know, it's similar to when a new player comes in and hasn't played much for a team and you have to game plan for that guy a little bit. You don't know exactly how they're going to go within that team. You can look at old footage. You can look at, you know, how they've been used elsewhere. And in this case, how, you know, the coach has done tactically. But you never know exactly what's going to be done until there's, you know, several games under a belt. You know, sometimes it takes even a full season to kind of get a feel for what a coach wants to do. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a challenge for the Crew this week. You know, Columbus, ever since Greg's taken over, has been very much of the approach that we're going to play our game. We want to kind of dictate that to the opponent, and then the opponent has to adjust to us. Now, they've changed that a little bit in the last year or so. I think MLS has forced them to do that at points. But, you know, I think that'll kind of be the approach this week is, you know, let's go out, let's do what we do, and you know, try and find ways to hurt Orlando that way.
Patrick, before we let you go, a couple things I wanted to talk about. The first of those is, and neither one of them may be things that Columbus fans would like to talk about, but
okay.
The first is Greg Berhalter is a name that has been very widely reported as a U.S. men's national team candidate, and just wanted to get, you know, with your resources, you know, what you're hearing on that front. Do you think Greg is the favorite? You know, how has the team sort of responded to those rumors and all of that kind of thing?
The team's responded well. I think, you know, Greg has handled it with, you know, he'll answer the questions. And, you know, I think that when he first started getting asked about it, he kind of distanced himself from that a little bit without saying, you know, no, I'm not going to take that job. Recently, it's been a little bit more, representing my country as a player was such a great honor. And, you know, if the time comes that I would be able to do it as a manager and if the situation were right, you know, then that would be an honor, too. So there has been kind of a change in the way he answers those questions, which, you know, I don't know if you should read into that too much. But Greg's usually pretty calculated with how he answers things. So I don't know if there's anything going on behind the scenes in terms of talk with, you know, the national team and whatnot. Obviously, there was speculation when Ernie Stewart took over that general manager position that, you know, he has a relationship with Greg. But as Greg pointed out, you know, as a guy that grew up in the U.S. system, played for the national team, his brother works for U.S. soccer. You know, there's not many guys that would have been hired for that position that he wouldn't have had a relationship with. So he kind of brushed that off as not, you know, an indicator of anything. I think that Greg would be a good fit for the job. I would be interesting to see because he's had such a structured way of playing here that takes time to develop how that would work with, you know, when you have a camp of a week or so, you're trying to bring in players that fit that style. You know, we've seen it work in other countries. You know, I think Spain is probably the most recent example, but Germany as well, where guys have come up from the bottom playing an exact type of soccer. And you know, sometimes some players who are good get left out. Mm-hmm. So maybe that would be the approach. Maybe Greg would have to adjust, you know, to what players he has. But it would be interesting. I do think that U.S. soccer could use some of that structure. But, yeah, I don't know. I think Crew fans would love to see him stick around, but I have a feeling that the next question you're going to ask me has to do with sticking around in general. So we'll get to that.
Do you think Greg's the favorite?
I don't know. I guess one of the guys that I thought was right up there with Greg was Jesse Marsh, and obviously he just moved on from the Red Bulls. I think Greg Vanney has to be in consideration as well if we're talking, you know, local, you know, or MLS coaches. I think Greg is a favorite. I don't know about the favorite, mm-hmm. But you know, that's just me speculating. So, you know, I don't have any inside information with U.S. soccer, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, he turned Jossy Zardes into a useful player, so he's got to have something going for him. you correctly surmised about my final question. Just wanted to get an update on what's the latest on Save the Crew.
Well, we're kind of in a holding pattern right now, and it'll be that way probably into August. The most recent kind of notable events were down in Austin, and the city council down there passed two bills, I guess you would call them, that didn't seem to really fit together initially. One was that they will negotiate with Anthony Precourt on the land that you know, after several sites have been turned down, that they have identified for the potential stadium there. It's a site that's a little bit north of downtown Austin, and you know, they seem to deem it suitable. It was probably their third or fourth choice initially, but other sites didn't work out. So they're going to negotiate with him. But another bill that passed was that there are other interested parties in that land, and those people will be able to present their proposals at the next city council meeting, which is in August, and then they'll kind of go from there. So it kind of came out as a wash. Anthony will get to negotiate, but he's likely going to have to step up his offers for our offer for the land. Originally, they wanted to rent it for, I believe, like $1 a year, pay no taxes on it, and things like that. Now that there are going to be competing bids coming in August, I can't see that that would fly. One of the bids they're talking about, I believe it's like an arts music kind of center, and they're talking about paying upwards of $2 million for the land and things like that. So so we're kind of waiting to see what happens down there. From the Columbus level, from everything, you know, I've heard and understand, there are potential owners here that are willing to make a move if and when the league is ready to do so, in terms of, you know, buying the team from Anthony, or, you know, however that situation may work. I don't know what it would take for that to happen. I think a lot of Crew fans feel like there needs to be enough egg on Anthony's face with the whole Austin situation to force the league to make a move. You know, I don't know. There's also been some speculation that if the Austin sites don't work out, he could take the team elsewhere, which wasn't thought to be a possibility at first, because I don't know if we discussed this the last time I was on, but there was supposed to be a clause in the contract that said the only place the team can move is to Austin. Well, apparently there might be ways around that too. So it's going to be interesting. I think, and I mean that in a potentially negative way, I think things look better than they did, you know, 6 months ago, 4 months ago, even. You know, the fact that it hasn't been a smooth transition, I think, is a good sign, and also shows how poorly Precourt Sports Ventures did their homework on what they were going to have available to them in Austin. You know, I think they thought that bringing a professional sports team there would be enough to get things moving quickly, and that has not been the case at all. Meanwhile, in Columbus, there's been a lot of hell raised by fans, and you know, people have got local businesses and whatnot have gotten on board to show that there is support. What will be interesting with those local businesses is, you know, if and when the team does end up staying here, do they then put their money where their mouth is and, you know, become local investors in a team and whatnot? So we'll see. I do think local ownership, especially in a smaller market team, is important. And, you know, so if they can make that work, I think Columbus is a city where soccer can do well. You know, obviously you're competing against Ohio State football in the fall. You know, the Blue Jackets start up, you know, whenever hockey season starts up. So, you know, that's not really a major competitor. You've got minor league baseball in the summer, but, you know, that wouldn't be too big of an issue either. So I believe if it's, you know, sold right and handled correctly, and we've seen it in the past, that this could be a good place for soccer. And I think, you know, that's kind of the point that people have tried to make to MLS. Okay. So sorry for the long-winded answer. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a lot to unpack there.
No, definitely appreciate your insight there, because it's been a little bit quiet. Save the Crew has kind of gone a little bit back burner. I mean, outside Columbus, obviously, it's very much on the front burner there. I can only tell you from somebody who lived in Texas for 2 years that speed of bureaucracy is not, you know, rapid fire there in that particular location. But I will say that if Precourt was trying to move the team to Miami, it probably would have already fallen apart, because apparently you can't get a stadium there, as Mr. Beckham is finding out, although frankly, if you just grease the right palms, you can get anything in Miami. So, Patrick Murphy from Massive Report, thanks so much for being with us. Wish we had talked a little bit more about the matchup, but man, just so many topics to cover and so little time. But appreciate you returning to the podcast.
Absolutely. I'll be on anytime you guys need me.
All right, big thanks to Patrick Murphy from Massive Report for being with us on the show. I grew up just outside Columbus, and I lived in Columbus for a decade, so I am very much hoping that they can get the Crew situation under control and keep that team there, because I mean, I've seen firsthand what it does to people when their favorite sports team is taken away from them and what it does to a city. It's never good for anybody. You never want to see it.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
Thanks for jumping in there, Dave. I wasn't sure you were going to for a minute. All right, well, why don't we get to our Ask the Mainland podcast mailbag. You can do this two ways. You have any questions for us, you can direct them to us via email, and you can send those to themainland@gmail.com, and just hit us up with Ask the Mainland podcast in the subject line or the hashtag, which you can also use on Twitter to get us. We're at the Mainland. That's our Twitter. And hit us up with the hashtag, hashtag AskTMLPC. So let's start with our mailbag questions from the email. Lee Gavlik, friend of the podcast. He says, Dave, are you familiar with Mike Petke's latest rant?
I heard a little bit about it, yeah.
Yes, Mike Petke of Real Salt Lake was an unhappy man about the officiating in the loss to Minnesota United. It says he doesn't care. Drain his bank account. He doesn't care. He needs to say something about the officials. Anyway, Lee wants to know, after Mike Petke's latest epic rant from this past weekend, do you agree that pro officials should be made available to the media after each game, similar to coaches and players? He says it could definitely help give some much-needed transparency to the fans, and it might also hold referees accountable for their officiating decisions. But I could also see how it might further enrage certain fan bases, players, and coaches, creating a very negative and perhaps even dangerous environment at the stadium when certain members of the professional referees organization come to town. Dave, what do you think? Should pro referees, or should referees in any sport, especially soccer, be made available for questions from the media after the game?
I absolutely love the idea. I don't think it'll happen, but I absolutely love the idea. I mean, can you just imagine the press conference and the reporters afterwards asking about individual calls and this and that? This is one of those things that sounds great when you hear it and you're like, yes, do that. Hold those suckers accountable. But it's not going to happen. And I'm not, as I talk it through, I'm not even sure that it should. Officiating is incredibly hard. I'm not sure that, you know, we say all the time, pro going to pro, and I'm not saying that these guys are the best in the world, obviously. But it is a hard thing to do in live action time, while watching professional players, you know, move at that speed. So, I think it wouldn't be a question if there was a semblance of more accountability from the league and from pro when they do mess up. I think the lack of that is what's prompting this feeling of, you know, let us grill them. So I think if they were to do a little bit more internally, but you know, public, here's what we did and here's why, then it wouldn't be as big of a deal. I don't think either of those are going to happen, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they should be made to stand at a podium and answer questions from the media. I don't think that that's a – I don't think that's an environment that helps the sport. But I do think there should be some accountability. The main thing that MLS should do is make these referees just comply with the rules that are in place, which is that if there are questions about a call, what happens is there's a pool reporter. In our case, it's Mike Gramajo. I am the backup pool reporter at Orlando City Stadium for MLS games, where, you know, people will hand Mike a question. Mike has to turn it in at the end, you know, before the end of the game, so that it's there waiting for them. And then they can make a written reply. The problem is that these referees are not – they're basically not answering the question. They're just saying, you know, hey, why did you call a handball in the box? I saw a handball in the box. I mean, it's really that ridiculous, that the answers that you get from them.
Right.
And you can't – you can't – they don't have to. They're not required to answer any questions about video review. They're not required to answer any of them. So if you ask, you know, what did the video assistant referee say to you about that goal that you overturned, you know, they don't even have to answer you. They just say, that's a VAR question. I don't have to answer it. And it's something that's being worked on, I can assure you, by you know, the organization, the soccer writers from North American Soccer Writers, and it's being addressed, and I know everybody involved seems to want this to be fixed. It seems to want this. I mean, supposedly the referees, the supposedly pro wants this fixed. MLS wants this fixed. Certainly the writers do. It's not, I think, out of the realm of possibility to, or, you know, I don't think it's asking too much, I guess I should say, to get an honest answer of, you know, why did you, for example, overturn Dom Dwyer's goal, which appeared to be a good goal, didn't appear to be a clear and obvious error, with with just the hearsay of the video assistant referee, and then it didn't seem like you even bothered to look at the Diamande goal that supposedly crossed the line, but we couldn't really tell, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's just that's what's so frustrating as a fan, is you don't get to even hear any kind of reasoning. And that's, you know, that's why, you know, when we had Daniel Bird on, that I asked him that question. It's like, what were you told on the sideline? Because, you know, we don't have anything to go on. They're not accountable. They don't have to tell you. And that's the other thing, the other part of accountability, Dave, to me, is that if you have a colossal blunder that costs a team points to the, you know, we've seen this several times with Orlando City pro coming out and saying that we got that call wrong. There's no accountability for those officials. Now, every once in a while, they say, you know, they may not be in the next week in the lineup anywhere, and we're told that that's not being, you know, punitive. But I think it's not out of the. I don't think it's too much to ask that if you screw a team out of a goal, or give a team erroneously a goal, you should be gone for a few weeks, not just 1 week. I think you need to go back and you need to observe. And you need to get better at your job. And, yeah. You know, particularly when it's an obvious error that the organization has to come out and apologize for after the fact. And, you know, it's everything you do in life, there's a job review. You know, any job you have, there's a job review. And this is part of the situation. If I screwed up colossally at work and cost my organization $1 million, do you think I'd be allowed back in the week after next?
Probably not.
No, it's not happening. So, so I agree there should be some accountability, and I do appreciate this question from Lee. Thank you so much for asking that, and hopefully I didn't ramble too much about it. We have a question from Greg in the email, and this is the one I was talking about earlier. Over the last three games, the Pride have had the whistle blown on them 35 times, three games, 35 times, as opposed to their opponents having only been called for 13 fouls. Add to that, they've accumulated 7 yellow cards and 1 red to their opponent's 1. Do you think the Pride play that much more physically, or are these stats indicative of what appears to be poor officiating in the league? Well, I'll start with this one. I think that the Pride are not physical enough. I think that the part of it is not necessarily physicality. Part of it is late or clumsiness or some cases tactical fouls because players have been beaten. But I do agree with you that 35-13 is a bit ridiculously weighted against Orlando. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. I'm not saying that teams, you know, that the league or that the officials want Orlando to lose. Again, I will always err on the side of incompetence can explain a lot of, you know, more than a conspiracy can when Correct. It comes to officiating. But the Houston game was an abomination. I mean, for a team to go an hour without a foul is unthinkable, as physical as that game was. And yes, the referee let some things go both ways. But boy, they were letting a lot more things go one way than the other. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, where if you have a game like that, you need to be reviewed, critiqued. And if you have a game like that, you need to be sitting for a couple of weeks and let it affect your paycheck. That's the only way to make these refs get better at their job. There's no incentive. They're not going to miss any games. They're not going to miss you're not missing a paycheck. There's no incentive to get better. And I think that they need to get better. And they need to talk to some other organizations around the world. I will say this, you will not find a fan, or let me say, you will rarely if ever, find a fan of any sport anywhere in the world who says, oh, man, you know what? Our league has fantastic officiating. No one says this. So it's not just here, although I watch a lot of European soccer. I watch some South American soccer. I don't see as many egregious calls around the league, you know, around the world as I see here. In fact, we just had a few weeks ago, there were three red cards overturned in a week, three in 1 week. And we have video review. How is this possible?
Yeah, that shouldn't be a thing that's happening in anywhere. But of course, it's happening here. So, you know, because we can't have nice things, especially when it comes to our officiating. You're right. It's completely out of whack, especially in that Houston game. That was, you know, you can say that that was an outlier, but it was utterly, I mean, lopsided in the calls, and there's nothing, like you said, no accountability. So how do you fix it? If you don't have any accountability, how do you fix it? Because once again, like you said, what's the incentive for them to do better? I agree with you, and we've said it many, many times. Don't, you know, mistake incompetence for conspiracy, and I know that you and I will both stand by that. That doesn't mean that it's a good thing, because that just means that we have incompetent, at least a part of the time, officiating. Mm-hmm. So it's not. We don't say that to make you feel better,
right? And I don't like you know? To go. I don't even like to bring up officiating on this podcast. I don't like to talk about it. I don't like to write about it. It shouldn't
impact the game, right?
It should be wallpaper.
Should be silent.
Officials right. should be wallpaper. You should even know they're there. But unfortunately, sometimes you do, and it happens. It seems to happen a lot against Orlando City. It hasn't really been a lot against the Pride, although the last few games, or last couple games, I would say, it certainly has been a little bit weighted the other way. But that I don't think it's been that way the entire season. Now, I at least not that I've observed. I could be totally wrong and go back and look at the numbers and say, whoa. But it certainly stood out at Houston. Because I was keeping an eye on it, and I was keeping an eye on all the physical contact and all of the stuff that was being let go and all of the things that I thought shouldn't have been let go. And then it got to be halftime and Houston had no fouls. And I was like, how is it possible to go through half a game without a foul? And especially in a game this physical. And that's the kind of game that referees tend to lose control of, because they let everything go. And then players get mad, they get frustrated, they get tired, and they start taking matters into their own hands. Well, nothing's getting called, so I'm just going to chop this person down. And, you know, that's how these things escalate. And referees should control the game. They shouldn't be letting them escalate. And they shouldn't, you know, I think if you have to make a couple harsh calls early in a game to set the tone, then do it. But so, Greg, to answer your question, what, if anything, you think can and should be done to improve the officiating? I think hit them where it hurts. Make them get better by affecting their bottom line. That's what I think. And I think also there needs to be a better, probably a lot better grassroots training program for officials in this country. I don't think it's probably where it needs to be. Yeah, that's what I've got for you. I think there are good officials probably in the USL that are ready to play, you know, ready to do MLS games. Maybe they should be given a chance earlier. I think this, quite frankly, there's some MLS referees that I think are not quick enough to keep up with the game anymore. There's a few that are a little bit long in the tooth and maybe not in the greatest shape. So I think all of those things go hand in hand. But, you know, I think that the hire of Howard Webb last year should be improving things. These things take time. But how much time before you say this is not working and we need something else? I don't know. I'm willing to give them another year or so to see if things get better since the Howard Webb signing. So anyway, Greg, thanks for the email. I would say your last name, but I'm not sure I would pronounce it without hurting myself or offending you in some way. So
just know that we appreciate you nonetheless.
Greg M., thanks for the question. I think we have one question more from Twitter. This is from Ryan Smith. Ryan says, Dom has the backflip. Chris Mueller has the Johnny Manziel pay me. Well, he also did the Cristiano Ronaldo thing. Although it's been a while since we haven't seen Chris in a while get to celebrate. So what is your signature celebration? Also, favorite team celebration routine you've seen?
Okay, so my signature, I'd like to say that it's something flashy. More than likely, if I was able to get down and score a goal, it would be just falling to my knees with a great sense of relief and probably out of breath. But if I was able to do anything, I'm going to go all out dance moves. I'm talking the, mowing the lawn, the sprinkler, the, getting the stuff off the aisle, putting it into the shopping cart. Every stupid dance move you can think, I'm doing them all the way over to the sideline. Favorite team celebration. I gotta go way back to the Icky Shuffle. A bunch of our listeners probably have no idea what I'm talking about, but I imagine you can look it up on YouTube. But yeah, the Icky Shuffle would be my favorite team celebration.
Man, that's a good question. I'm not sure if Ryan's asking what is my signature celebration, like as in my favorite signature celebration, or the one that I would choose to use. I'm not sure what Ryan's getting at here, but I assume the way it's worded, what is your signature celebration means like what I would do. And like my first thought at reading this question was that I would like to do something different every time, kind of like some of these football celebrations that we've seen in recent years.
Yeah.
But then I thought I would, that would be just too much work to think of a new one every time. and so I think I would do, you think you went back a ways. Everybody's going to have to YouTube, search this one. I would probably do the Billy White Shoes Johnson dance.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Billy White Shoes Johnson, former NFL player, long, long time ago. Look him up if you don't know it. It is a kind of a crazy, funky dance. I liked it. I always thought it was great whenever he did it. I would do that. Favorite team celebration routine that you've seen? I kind of like – this happened a while ago. When Brian Roches was on the team, Brian Roches scored a goal. And for some reason, him and Chris Nagita got down on the ground and did sort of like an alligator crawl.
Okay. I remember that. Yeah.
And I think that was great. I would love to see that more. So yeah, that was my favorite team celebration. It just happened to be an Orlando City one. So it ties in. So there you go. Thank you, Ryan, for the question. Again, ask us anything every week. Email us at themainland@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter. We are @themainland. Use that hashtag AskTMLPC. Dave, Orlando City has two games coming up. A game tonight. Woo-hoo! Tonight in the U.S. Open Cup could push the team further than it's ever been in the U.S. Open Cup competition. A win at Philadelphia would make Orlando a semifinalist. And at that point, I think Orlando has actually applied to host a game, so that could be a home game for the semifinals, and they would be actually a win against Philadelphia would put them two wins away from Champions League play. That's pretty crazy.
That's given the season, that's exciting.
Absolutely. But with that said, I need your key matchups and your final score prediction for the U.S. Open Cup match at the Philadelphia Union.
All right, so key matchup. I'm going back to something you mentioned in the last game, which was how the defensive midfield and the defensive front or the defensive line was able to shut down part of the field. I think they're going to have to do that again against Philadelphia. You've got to. Bedoya in there, and of course you've got Sapong coming up up top. So I think if they can win that defensive end, then they've got a good chance. Prediction, man. I'm going to be hopeful. I'm going to allow a little luck of the Irish here with James O'Connor and say that Orlando City does advance. They do so by a score of 2-1.
All right, interesting. I'm going to say that my key matchup is going to be the defense, the back line, because, again, no Spectre, no Sutter, no Sané. The killer S's, they're killing us because they're injured. They're all gone. So does James O'Connor come back with a short week Amro Terek, a short week Chris Schuler? Does he try to get creative and go back to like an RJ Allen, Tony Rocha kind of thing that we saw earlier in the year? Does Shane O'Neill get his first look? He was in the 18 on Saturday. I don't know how he's going to handle that, but however he handles that, those four guys across the back against Sipong, Akam if he plays, Corey Burke, those are guys that could put the ball in the net. Sipong and Akam in particular have been very effective against Orlando City throughout their careers. So I see that as the key matchup. Can the back four in what might be a tired back four that traveled, how will they do against a very fresh Philadelphia attack? That leads me into my score prediction, because Philadelphia didn't play this weekend, Dave. They did have a friendly against Eintracht Frankfurt, but the starters didn't play but 30 minutes. And not many of the regulars even played after halftime, before halftime. So not a lot of miles on the legs. They didn't have to travel. They're going to be much fresher. I don't see Orlando City winning this game because the Union have, especially in recent years under Jim Curtin, have actually played quite well in this tournament and have gotten all the way to the finals, I believe, twice, or at least the semifinals. And that's going to be in their favor. The experience is going to be in their favor. Being fresh is going to be in their favor. Being at home is going to be in their favor. They got a lot going in their favor. I just think it's going to be a lot to ask of Orlando City. So I see this as a 2-1 Union victory.
Well, I did say I was being hopeful and referenced the luck of the Irish. So if O'Neill is in there, then that's double the luck.
Always hopeful yet discontent. He knows changes aren't permanent, but change is.
Nice.
The right people will get that. All right. So U.S. Open Cup, though, very much up in the air. If Orlando can somehow come away with that in advance, they're, like I said, just two wins from a potential appearance in CONCACAF Champions League. And with the season going the way it has, as you mentioned, who would have thought that? But it's been a good run either way. Even if they bow out on the road against Philadelphia, it's been a really decent little run. You know, I mean, as much as a two-game run can be, getting to the quarterfinals is always good. So either way, I'm going to tip my cap to the Lions Wednesday night after the game. Hopefully it will be in celebration. Not the city of celebration, which is just south of Orlando, but the act of celebration. We've got another game coming up Saturday to talk about. Columbus Crew on the road. I believe the Crew Stadium is still not seen an Orlando City victory. The Crew has not played great of late, as we discussed with Patrick Murphy. The team has only won one of its last eight games. It has drawn three of those games, but those, I think, were the first three games of the run. And lately, the Crew not finding the net, but the Crew has not had trouble finding the net against Orlando City through the years. They typically score a couple of goals against Orlando, especially at home. Higuain is a big pain in the rear end for Orlando, and they've got some dangerous players. They've got a very good defensive team. They don't give up a lot of goals, and that will be Orlando's third game in 8 days. Dave, what's your key matchup there and your final score prediction?
Well, now I'm catching up to you in that I'm going to go with the back line this time in the key matchup. Zardes has been having a pretty decent year up there. Like you said, they've got Higuain, Will Trapp. There's guys up there that are going to cause some problems. And as you mentioned, third game traveling again. For me, it's going to be the back line this time. I'm going to call this one a 2-1 loss going the other direction on this one. I think this is the game where the legs fail us and it falls apart in that respect. So 2-1 loss to the Crew.
I am going to say my key matchup is going to be in the midfield, is going to be, can the defensive midfielders thwart Higuain the way that they kind of, for the most part, handled Giovinco and his influence on the game? Because like Giovinco, although Giovinco is a much better finisher and much craftier, more slippery guy, I think unlike Giovinco, Higuain's a guy who's more influential in the midfield part. But both of those players really are adept at pulling the strings just above the penalty area. So it's going to be imperative that, you know, whoever plays defensive midfield, whether it be Yotun, Aguita, Rossell, Johnson, or Powers or Rocha, those guys are going to have to keep Higuain from being able to pull those strings, because generally Columbus is successful at scoring goals when Higuain is assisting them or setting them up or putting the wheels in motion. You know, maybe it's a 3 or 4 pass sequence, but he usually is the one starting it. So he's the guy that they got to watch out for. I think that's the primary matchup. The secondary matchup is going to be, can the attacking midfield get past Will Trapp and expose the back line? And that's been a problem for a lot of teams. I'm going to say my score prediction is going to be 1-0 Columbus. I see a low scoring game. I see an Orlando team without a lot of energy, having been on the road. I think it's going to be a tough one for Orlando to come away with a result.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We both predicted a loss, so it'll probably not be 2-1 or 1-0. It'll be something else.
Yeah, well, it'll either be a draw, a win for Orlando City, or an absolute shellacking.
Exactly.
Something like that. All right. Sorry to be a downer at the end of this program. We started it off
right?
So happy.
I know, it was so great.
So we will be back next week. We'll have a lot to cover, obviously. We will have a couple of Orlando City games to discuss, a U.S. Open Cup game and a league game in the middle of a very brutal stretch of games. In fact, after Saturday's game, they'll have a bit of a short week, a Thursday game against New York City FC, followed by a Sunday affair out in L.A. against the Galaxy. Got to go back across the country again, Dave. It's just, not the greatest travel schedule that this team has had ever since it left for Miami.
It's what we do.
So, you know, next year, maybe don't give us like 6 home games out of the first 8. Kind of break up some of that travel a little bit. Although next year, both LA teams will have to come to Orlando. So that'll limit the West Coast trips. And in honesty, Vancouver will have to come here too. The team will have to go to Seattle and Portland and San Jose. So it's still 3 trips out there, but hopefully not in the same month. Because that's a little much to ask for anybody.
Well, you would think so, but don't put that out there.
Don't put it out there. But, I can't say that I've been thrilled with any of the schedules that we've had so far. I mean, there have been good points about them and bad points about them. I think 2015 might have been the best schedule the team's had in its 4-year history. But anyway,
yeah,
you got to play them the way they're dealt. And not much you can do about it. So we'll talk about those games. We'll talk obviously about the Pride against Seattle. And next week, as we will be heading into the Tournament of Nations, preparing for New York City FC again, and that will be a home game, and the Galaxy as well. So a lot to talk about next week. Get your questions in for Ask the Mainland Podcast. Anything. Again, hashtag AskTMLPC on Twitter. And via email, themainland@gmail.com. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, read our stuff at themainland.com, subscribe to this podcast. I didn't look this week, Dave. There weren't any new reviews last week. I haven't looked this week. We'll look next week. I got a lot to do. 5-star review on iTunes and write something out. You know, we'll read it on the air. I think that's it, Dave. You got anything to add?
No, just that they can find you at Mainland Michael and me at Mainland Dave on the Twitters. Other than that, let's end this on a high note.
OK. Okay, how would we do that?
Oh, man, I was hoping you were going to do the Blazing Saddles thing. Dang it. We tried.
I'm spent, as they say, as Austin Powers once said. Anyway, that'll do it for episode number 134. Thanks to Patrick Murphy for joining us from a massive report. And thanks to my co-host, David Rowe. On his behalf, I will sign off this episode of the Mainland Podcast the way I always do, by saying, go City and go Pride.